So, curious question. What audience does a study of the influence of adjusting people's income have to do with pipeline integrity? If you've never, ever been curious about that, you should listen to today's episode where we talk about the influence of truncated data, what that means on a level 3 validation in API 1163. And if you're curious, well, Rhett, I don't do an 1163 level 3 validation. On this episode, we talk about maybe why you should. And can you say, Christopher, hello, MAOP reconfirmation via ECA? Join us. All right, welcome to today's episode of Pipeline Things. I am your host, Rhett Dotson, my co-host, Christopher De Leon, and we are excited to be with you as we continue our series on IBC publications from 2022. And I like what we have coming today. It's one that makes me think, which I like, Christopher.
And it's with somebody we like. I like him.
I think this person likes you too. I mean, they told
Does
me the whole reason
jealous?
That they
Are you jealous?
Maybe a little. I maybe mean, when a guest says that when the guest says that they're filming because of you and I don't get mentioned,
look,
then it's
it does. Rhett, I've always told you, brother, you are the spotlight. Like, people wonder
except in this episode.
People always wonder, like, it's D2, so who's D1 and who's D2?
Look,
right?
Let's not reveal that to the audience. Let's leave it. For the time being, when we were prepping for this show,
yeah.
I had a thought. Do you read?
Do I read?
Do you read? Do you read? There's a difference. Do you read?
He's spicy today. I wonder what he ate for lunch. Yes, I read. But it depends what. I read for fun.
Cool. I read for fun too, but my I've been on behavioral economic theory.
Yeah, you've mentioned this for a while.
Yeah, I know.
You're
doesn't
wanting
get
to understand
excited.
People. People are complex.
I do. So one of the things that I read recently was the hidden cost of free. Right.
Oh,
so
yeah.
People don't often think about
yep.
the hidden cost of free. But from a marketing perspective, as you drop the price down for something, there's not a linear response to you get to free. When you get to free, people just behave completely irrationally because, like, they don't justify the cost of free. So in your own life, think about this.
Yeah.
So
I've got a perfect example of kind of what you're
talking about.
Do
you really?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not free, but it's low cost, right? It's this, I don't know if y'all have heard, like, this family got an allergic reaction when they were at Disney. And the lady ended up passing because of allergic reaction, and they tried to sue. And apparently they lost because when they signed up for the Disney Plus app, it says you cannot sue us for anything, basically. And so they lost a totally disconnected thing. I signed this, yes, I agree to your terms for the app, but when I go to Disney and you kill me because you didn't pay attention to my allergies, you can't sue me now.
Wow. Okay, that was a little different. I was thinking, take it back, I mean, two notches. My wife likes to go to Starbucks, and she went and waited an hour in line for, like, the Starbucks free, the free holiday cup that they got. Yeah. I was like, you waited an hour in line? The thing probably cost $5. Like, I can't give up an hour of my time.
She's like,
I was already in line.
Bro,
I was stuck. It was free. I went with it. You know, and people behave irrationally when you set the price of something to free.
This time is going to be perfect. Hey, PSL is real.
What's PSL?
Pumpkin spice latte, bro. It is real, right? It's kind of like when Chick-fil-A brings back the peach milkshake. Like, it is real.
So I think it's going to make sense when we bring on the guest and we get into it. But as he was
the cost
talking,
of free.
Yeah, that, it's not the cost of free because nothing's free in our industry. Yeah, I don't want our clients
cost.
To get any ideas. But yes, there's an opportunity cost that we often don't consider with things.
Yeah.
Free is a really good example in our own lives when you drop it free. Again, people will often pay more for something because it's free. And marketing takes that into account in everything
and,
that we do.
And obviously, I mean, probably a little bit of a spoiler, right? Just to connect the dots. Like, it might not be free, but the lack of effort as well, right? When something, you don't have to lean into it or you don't have to go through the effort. It's analogous in this
so,
topic that we're going to talk about today.
I guess it's time to bring on our guest and
we
can let them know. Do you want to introduce him? Go ahead, Christopher. I want you to, he is obviously you're his first love out of the D2 group. You should bring on the guest this time.
All right. Well, hey guys, I have the privilege of bringing on Jason Scow. He's I consider him a good friend of mine, brilliant Really plugged into ILI, really plugged into the numerical methods of learning how to use ILI. So really looking forward to having you on the show, brother. Welcome.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. And just to be clear, Rhett, you know,
Jason, it's okay. Don't defend it. It's okay.
I love Chris, but it's only because I know him better. And, you know, from what I can tell, like, lots of potential with you too. So
you don't You know what? I will actually relinquish my role as like the host on today's show. Oh, I will really? Just be a guest on the show as I watch Jason and Chris have a friendly conversation.
Oh, so. No. Again, we haven't had a segue where you and I have like talked about ongoing. So a little deep dive into our business, right? So I may know people first, but once they meet this guy, they stop calling me. They always call this guy. So I totally expect that to happen.
I don't see that. I don't see it. Because now I'm so hurt by Jason's love for you that I don't know if we can get past that gulf in order to build that bridge. But Jason, you're our guest today. Thank you for joining us so much. We brought you on because of your IPC 2022 paper, Estimating Measurement Performance with Truncated Data Sets, which is a mouthful, but I don't think it's actually as complicated. So our audience, I want you guys to hang on, because what Jason is going to talk about today has a lot to do with topics of interest for you, namely, how do you validate an ILI 1163 and what those methods mean. And it's going to be a jam-packed episode, but it's also going to be a lot of fun. Before we get too deep into that, Jason, tell us a little bit about yourself, please. Introduce yourself to the audience, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah. No, I'm happy to. And so my name is Jason Scow. I've been in the pipeline industry, I should say oil and gas industry, about 23, 24 years. My first role was as a plant engineer in a refinery. But then soon after that, I moved into the pipeline world and I worked for a pipeline operator in Saskatchewan. I started off doing distribution, designing town border stations, regulator letdown stations, and, you know, new loops inside cities and towns, but then moved on to integrity. That was when they were expanding their integrity group. I think they had one or two people in integrity and they needed like a third. So this was a much smaller integrity group than you find now, even at the same company. And I think the same has been replicated in other operating companies. So I was doing pipeline integrity. I was doing pigs and digs. I was out in the field every summer. I'd spend probably about 2 months worth of time out in the field, you know, doing fitness for service evaluations, doing modifications, sometimes some cutouts, and just making sure the integrity of the pipe was what we expected. So that was my life for a while. I loved it. I loved being out in the field. I loved working with, you know, the instrument techs. I loved working with the welders, the operators, and I learned a lot. You know, one thing I learned was that although we're working with a fairly simple asset, you know, it's a pipeline, it's like a tube kind of, every time I went to the field, something different. Every time, something different. There's so much variety, like reality is so complex compared to our simple models. And so I really gained an appreciation for that. And I really gained an appreciation for just the team of people that is necessary to make everything happen. And I was just sort of one part of that team, like one step in that sort of ladder, but everyone together sort of made it happen. And I tried really hard to work with that team, gain their confidence and really understand what they were doing, their positions and stuff like that. So it was fantastic. After my role there, I moved on to a more of a research role. That was Seifert Technologies. I was working basically for the Alberta government at that time, did that role for maybe 8 years. And then found that, you know, sometimes government can kind of handcuff you a little bit. Like, you know, government's not the right place for innovation. It's not the right place for business. It definitely has a role. And I, you know, played that role for a while. But then I decided, you know, we've got a confluence of market forces that are demanding an answer. I don't know if you guys felt the same, but I would summarize it as simply democratization of the CPU. That's the cloud computing, meaning somebody like me and a small group of, you know, professionals could have access to computing power as big as the supercomputers out there and for very low cost. So democratization of the CPU, we have machine learning type algorithms that are becoming mainstream, meaning engineers can use them for practical purposes. They're not research projects in a, you know, scientific lab or, you know, university lab somewhere, you know, that you can just use. You can download a library, a Python library or something like that, or maybe even a, you know, Excel plugin, stuff like that, and becomes usable for practical purposes. And then thirdly, at the same time, aging infrastructure. Infrastructure is getting older. We can't replace it near fast enough that we, you know, that we need. It's a critical part of the industry, of the economy, even. You know, I've heard some economists even claim, you know, energy is the economy. So, you know, we have such a reliance on a strong, secure source of energy just to make everything else work. You know, like you don't have an iPhone without good energy. Mm. So, you know, just a core element, and the infrastructure is aging. So what could I do to contribute to that world is, you know, hopefully use computing power, machine learning algorithms, and experience in integrity services to keep the asset in shape, running longer, past design life, keep it safe, you know, protect people, protect the environment. And that's what we're trying to do.
And so in all of that, one of the things I'm most surprised on is, do you remember when you first met Chris?
I mean, it was at PRCI. It was at PRCI.
It's always memorable, right? You know this, right? It's always memorable.
And I think like the very first time I met him, I was in a PRCI. There was one of the projects was being discussed.
That's enough. That's actually, I don't need to.
I got to tell you. Yeah. And then I left. I had to go take a call. I come back. Chris is in my seat. I think that's the first time I saw him. But then after that, you know, we started chatting. And I think at the time, Chris, you were with Rosen.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, we had a lot of good discussions. You know, I think our friendship kind of grew from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jason. So for indulging. That's going to happen a lot throughout the podcast, by the way. And
I'm going to do that the next place we go. Wherever he goes and sits down, I'm just going to sit in his seat.
For
and
real.
I'm going to write Jason on it.
I like how
it's a free seat, right? It's a free seat.
It's true. There was a cost to joining it. You just didn't know what it was going to give you. So I like how we had a guest that joined us in the podcast, too. The cat totally jumped up in the background. That was great. So we have a new guest. So, Jason, tell us a little bit about this paper. Layman's terms, what drove you to do this paper? Like, set the stage for me a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, this paper is playing off of one of the techniques that's listed in the API 1163, and it's about validation of measurement tools. And, you know,
when you say measurement tools, 1163 is all geared towards ILI tools, right? So when you say measurement tools, you're talking about validation of ILI measurement tools? Is that how the audience should understand
that? Yeah, 1163 is all about ILI. But in fact, the reason I said measurement tools, that's actually very astute of you to pick that out, because I've used the same techniques for other types of measurement tools. Mm-hmm. Really, really what it is, it's about anytime you have a measurement that you do a lot of and it's cheaper, and then you have a reference measurement that you do fewer of that are more expensive. Anytime you have that situation, it could be in medicine, it could be in refineries, it could be, you know, radiography, it could be a new technique that we borrowed from NASA to try to measure stuff on our pipelines, whatever it is. If you have those conditions where you have one measurement where you have lots of it and another reference measurement, better quality, and you have fewer of them, they're usually more expensive, then you can apply this technique for validation. However, in our industry, you're absolutely right. This is applied primarily to ILI tools. But you could imagine, you know, if we come up with a new technology or we're testing a new technology and the question was, is this ready for prime time? How good is this compared to other technologies? You would actually use the same techniques. So it is generalizable to more other types of measurements as well.
All right. So going back, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were setting the stage and you said, so we have an example in 1163. Level. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. And so what we want to do is we want to validate measurements, and 1163 lays out three methodologies to validate. So they're called level one, level two, and level three. And the one that the paper's about is a level three. You know, I was able to contribute to the appendix of API 1163, the current version, and wrote one of the examples using a level three. So I kind of had that under my belt. I had been thinking about those level three measurements. And then this paper kind of came from that because I was working with an operator who was really interested in applying level three. And so we tried it with the data set. We encountered some difficulties, and truncation is one that I'll get into. But basically the idea of the three levels of validation are, and I think Chris was alluding to this at the beginning, the intro to the podcast, is you do the amount of work that is proportional to the cost of making an error, right? So, if you need a very quick validation, and maybe the error, if you get it wrong, it's maybe not that big of a deal, or maybe that's something that you can overcome, or maybe have some safeguards for that. Well, then you just kind of stop your effort. You don't continue and do, you know, a PhD research project every time. You just do what's necessary. But in some cases, you may need to be more accurate. You may need to have more confidence in the numbers that you're presenting. Maybe you're presenting those to upper management or regulators or something. And so different levels of validation are appropriate under different circumstances. And this one in particular was level three. That's the more detailed one. And then the paper focuses on the problem of truncated data, meaning if some of the data is missing out of the data set, can you still do it? The answer is yes. And the paper kind of outlines how to do that.
Cool. So for clarity, just for the audience is curious. So when you say you worked on the latest version, we're talking about the 2001 version of 1163?
2021, I believe.
2020. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's what I meant. 2021. Yeah.
You just went back two decades.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Wow. Yeah, 2021. Sorry about that. Okay, just to be clear.
No so, worries. So is it fair to say, Chris, and I'm interested in your opinions, when we talk about level one, level two, and level three, I feel like I see very few level two assessments. Mm. I think I can count on one hand how many level three assessments I've seen operators do. What do you think about that?
So I'll add, as part of answering your question, I'll add to Jason, right? So 1163, I think, is fundamental for pipeline integrity, right? It outlines the process in which operators should use inline inspection. I won't get into all that, but it's a lot more than just the validation component, right?
Right.
And in it, one of the things that I always talk to our clients about is it's based on the risk that the pipeline has and the cost of getting something wrong as it ties to that risk should be a factor in which you choose, am I doing a level one, level two, and level three? And as part of that decision process, not only is it the risk of getting something wrong or the risk that that line carries, the consequent side of risk, but it's also how much of an understanding you have with that ILI system or how much information you can get from it. So for example, if you say, hey, we've used this MFL ILI system for the last 4 years, you know, we've done, you know, 140 digs on it. And I've, as it says in 1163, yeah, I've maintained a database of my findings and the performance. Then that's where level one can step in and you can say, hey, I've already done a ton of work. I'm going to pull that work forward because all the essential variables as defined in the ILI system remain. And so therefore, I'm going to use all that experience and say, I can do a level one on this pipeline, commensurate with risk, commensurate with data integration, commensurate with my experience for that ILI system.
Right. Okay.
Where the level two comes in is where you feel like you need to supplement a bit, right? So maybe you don't have as much experience or the risk is a little bit higher. You say, I'm going to go do a handful of digs. Right. And then there's the statistical means. I won't get into all that, but there's that what I'll call pretty straightforward statistical approach to where you can say, if I just do some work, it gives me an increased level of confidence that I can use this data. And then I'll pause there. So that's normally the
level
way
level one and level two. Okay. So then obviously a level three is one step beyond that. Yeah.
And the level three being that you are establishing the ILI system's performance. Specifically, and so you have
it for that inspection.
You're establishing it for that ILI system, and then there's some uncertain. Like you kind of get to. I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it that vague and
so
say
Jason,
each operator can use
what's
level
threes
they need.
What, and I'm curious, what's driving your operators to a level three? You mind shedding some light on that? I mean,
yeah. So you say you can count on one hand the number of level threes. For me, it's a bit more, and possibly because I was helping with that example that's in the 1163, so people kind of touch base with me maybe more frequently. However, I would agree with you that it's not the most common assessment. The most common assessment, I think, is level two and level one. I mean, level one, I think, is sort of default. Level two, done all the time. And then the level three is less common, I would say becoming more common. And so to be more direct in your question, okay, why a level three? I think there's several reasons for a level three where you'd want to go that way. One of them is, for example, let's say you don't have that experience that Chris was talking about with a technology stack. You're starting something new. Like this could be, for example, when EMAT came out and it was fairly new. At that time, there would be an ILI vendor spec, but you might also want to say, look, we're gonna do a little extra effort here because we haven't used this before. We're staking a lot of our reputation and projections with
social license. I mean,
social
all of it,
license,
right?
And so on. Yeah. So there's a lot riding on this. And now, other technologies, we have those. We have lots of experience with that, but this one's newer. So we want to do a little bit of extra work on this to find out, how do we think it's performing, independent of what the vendor is saying, or you can combine the two. Actually, in a level three, you can combine the two. You can use the vendor.
So hold up before he says anything. So we recently talked to Bruce, or it posted, and we were like, EMAT's like the baby. It's not the first child that you held it to all these high standards, right? And then you run EMAT, and you're like, well, I've kind of been through this. We can manage this one a little bit differently. I have a feeling that's where he was going with it.
No, actually, it wasn't. EMAT would have been a funny target, but no. What I was really thinking is y'all are mentioning the risk, right? I got it with a new ILI system's easy. I think though I want for a moment to think about the risk proposition. Mm-hmm. And actually where I went, and I don't know if you're familiar with updated regulation in the United States or how familiar you are with it, Jason, but I was thinking about the MAOP reconfirmation via ECA.
Mm-hmm.
And should something like a level 3, because of the risk associated with that, be something operators should be thinking about?
Why are you pushing my opinion buttons?
Because it occurred to me as y'all were talking about this. One of the riskiest places we might have would arguably be MAOP reconfirmation via ECA. And should you do a level 1? Yeah,
so I'm trying to be pretty vanilla on these podcasts and get our speakers to not be vanilla, but I'll say this, right? So in the US, unfortunately, I feel like how to use level 1, level 2, and level 3 isn't always well understood.
I agree.
Which is why I was happy that you guys won the project at PRCI to have the guidance document for using level 1, level 2s, and level 3s in a practical manner for inline inspection. But it kind of goes beyond that as well, right? It's like, I feel like level ones are used inappropriately because the appropriate level of data integration isn't there, right? And I don't think it's fair for industry. I won't just point at operators, because 1163 even says you have to name the responsibilities between the operator in the aisle and the service provider as to who's responsible for what. And too often that's a big gap, right? So 1163 outlines that the essential variables, the process by which a performance spec was established, needs to be documented and available for review. How many times have operators actually reviewed that and understood how that spec was established to give them the confidence that they could say, you know what, I'm comfortable doing a level one here, right? And so when you bring up that topic of MAOP ECA, it absolutely says, one, why are you using this tool? How is the performance exactly based? What work have you done on it? What's your data? Man, like, this is a whole podcast on its own.
We'll bring Jason back to talk about MAOP reconfirmation and the use of level threes in that case. You sparked it. I was looking for a reason, and that seems to be it.
That's an excellent example, right? Excellent example. And, just to kind of maybe add to that example, let's say you were looking for the, confidence that you could go with the vendor spec. Well, how about you do a level 3? You might calculate something that's the same as the vendor spec. Then you know you can replicate the vendor spec. Then you have higher confidence. You can rely on your own data set. I've actually even seen cases where the vendor spec is actually wider than what you calculate with a level 3. Mm. I mean, it doesn't often happen, but it can happen. It does happen. Some tools perform very well. And then if you're using a narrower spec, a more efficient program because you have tighter tolerances. Another one I would mention, because this is becoming more and more common, is many operators are doing quantitative risk assessments. One with the Monte Carlo where they're trying to figure out probabilities. In that case, the measurement performance is a key input. And so you might want to do, if you're going to do that style of a risk assessment, you may want to do a level 3 performance evaluation. So and that becomes an input to your risk assessment.
I've seen that application
many, many times where rather than just rely on the vendor spec or a level 2, which is more, can I reject the vendor spec or not? You calculate it with a level 3. That becomes an input to your next step in your process.
That actually makes a lot of sense. So I'm seeing the cases behind a level 3. Before we break, our friend Bruce said something, and I'm just going to ask you. When you do this, you should statistically show that all of the tools have the exact same statistical performance, right?
No, they won't show that.
And on that note, audience, we're going to take a break. We come back, I promise, we are going to dive into what these gaps in truncated data are. And you really want to hear the story behind how Jason got there and the application to level 3. We will be right back after a quick break. Welcome back to Pipeline Things, where we continue our conversation with Jason Scow on the truncated data sets and estimating measurement performance. So in that last beginning part of the episode, I think we did a good job really establishing level 1, level 2, level 3, and what drives a level 3. I appreciate you doing that. Now, Jason, I'm going to ask, I need you to deliver the baby for me, right? And the Reader's Digest in this publication, cut straight to the chase. What did you find and why does it matter?
Okay. Well, I mean, can I add one thing to the level one, level two, level three?
Well, I don't. Chris is going to let you because you're his favorite. So I'm not really going to get much of a say. So you might as well go ahead.
Okay. Well, it kind of leads into what you're asking me. So maybe that helps for context. The level one relies on past experience. It doesn't rely on new dig results from this ILI run that you're currently evaluating. So yeah. The data requirement's very small. The level two, you start to do some digs. Okay, pigs and digs. That's what I used to do. I was out in the field doing that. I was the engineer on site making calls, you know, cut that pipe out. Nope, you know, that's a clock spring, whatever. So the level two is you're going out to do digs. You're measuring this meticulously as you can out in the field. You're trying to find out, okay, the ILI called this, but then what did I find when I was there, you know, in person? What did I find? And the test that you do on level two is not saying I'm for sure confident that the spec was met. What you're saying is I'm not confident that I can disprove the spec. So therefore I just go with the spec. So if I collect data and the data kind of disagrees with the spec, but I don't have very much data, I'm still not confident that the spec was wrong. That means I still go with the spec. I just default back to the spec. Unless I collect
It's almost like data. Innocent until proven guilty. The spec is innocent until proven guilty.
Exactly. And that's the default. I mean, the vendors know their tools. This is the spec they provide. So then you kind of have to say, well, if I'm going to disagree with the spec, I better have lots of evidence to show that. However, the common case is that we collect data. It's very expensive to collect. So we actually don't collect that much. It's quite hard to get to be confident that the spec is wrong. So often we just end up defaulting back to the spec. Now, does that mean that the spec was achieved in your particular ILI run? Absolutely not. It just means that you don't have enough data to disprove the spec, to reject it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's normally the way we say it, right? It's you don't have enough evidence to reject it, right? And so ultimately, it puts you in a tough spot, right? It's like, hey, I have some data that's good, some that's kind of not sure, but at the end of the day, I don't have enough to reject it. If you want more to reject it, bump it up.
Yeah. And so then the level three is where you take the data that you have and you try to derive what the performance was from that data set. The actual performance in your particular run, because you know a tool can be different in one run versus another. There can be circumstances that lead to that. Some of it would be unknown. You know, why is there randomness? But essentially, it's not 100% constant across every run. I mean, that would be great if it was. How did it do in your particular run? How did it do on this pipeline? We're assessing this particular pipeline's integrity. And so that's really the answer we want to know. And a level three is very specific to the pipeline that you're assessing. Okay, so now why does it matter? When I was doing this assessment, it was with an operator that was testing different ILI tools. And they were comparing the performance of the two tools, deciding on which one they were going to run on other pipelines that were similar type pipelines. And so they wanted to know the performance, not just what the vendor told them, because, you know, you just go through the catalog and say, well, this one claims slightly better this, slightly better POD, slightly better, you know, tolerance bounds for this category of corrosion, whatever. You could just pick it from that. But what they wanted to do is they wanted to look at, you know, what could we calculate on the runs that we're doing? We wanted the evidence ourselves. We wanted to come up with the performance ourselves. So we're doing level three. And we encountered a difficulty, which is that data can be truncated. And what truncated data is when you have a data set, you can imagine a unity plot where there's like dots kind of like along a 45 degree line. You often see that. But just take the lower part of that, just cut it off, just disappear it.
Which can, at the reporting threshold.
Yeah, which can like happen 10%. For a lot of reasons, right? Like to make this practical, like you wanna have the best use of your resources, right? So it's like you likely won't go dig things that are benign or of no interest because it's not the best way to use your money. So you probably went and got the nasty stuff, which means you're probably on the upper end, right? The upper left quadrant of your unity plot. So what do you do with the lower stuff?
Interesting. Exactly. And the reporting threshold is a good example. If you have a reporting threshold, does that mean there are not features that are below that? Of course they exist. But we don't care about them. They're not integrity threats, for example, but they exist. And if you're evaluating the measurement performance and you're trying to come up with a unity line, you actually do want to know that they're there, even though they have no value for the assessment of the integrity. This is the assessment of just the performance of the tool itself. Now, if you cut that off, that's fine. However, the 45 degree line starts to get shallower because you have data missing. Just imagine you take the data away. Well, now you have less data. Yeah. So you kind of have a shallower line. That's an effect that always happens. Now, if you look at unity plots, you'll find a lot of them are not along the 45. They actually get tilted. They get shallower. And truncation is one of the key reasons for that. So in this paper, we were looking at if we have a truncated data set, which is very common. And in this particular case, we had that. Can we still do a level three with that data? And we checked a couple ways of trying to solve this problem and came up with one that we thought was really good.
So hold on, wait. I just want to make sure. I need to, because I'm chewing on what you said. Believe it or not, you know, Jason, people say I talk fast. You talk pretty quick. So I'm like, I got to keep up with Jason here. Imagine our listeners are keeping up with you too. Woo! Let's go. So layman's terms, again, we in a level one, we base it, or level two, we base it off of a 45 degree line, right? 1-to-1 between ILI and the field. And even when we put the tolerance bands, if I can use that, those are at a 45 degree. What you're suggesting is that when we truncate the data, even for reasons that are perfectly acceptable, such as a reporting specification, we shouldn't expect those lines to sit at 45 degree angles, because we've essentially biased the data set, might be one way to say it, or altered the data set.
Yeah, and I show that in the paper. So if you try to calculate the slope with the truncated data and just ignore that, you get a shallower slope. But now once you reintroduce the idea that, hey, we actually know there's data there, but it's just missing, now it gets closer to 45 again. It's not necessarily exactly 45, but it gets much closer to 45, which is what we expect.
And the idea behind the 45 for listeners, it's the whole component of unity, right? I mean, that's the idea, right? That what you're projecting is closer to what you were expecting, right? Not within spec, but rather the idea of it's a unity plot for a reason, right? You want the best alignment as possible represented by that 45 degree.
So now I'm so curious. Did you think of this on your own? Like, do you have an origin story for this? Were you on a boat and you saw the wake? Like,
He was ice fishing. And where did you get after the his third idea? Shot of fireball, light bulb went off.
I don't think he drinks.
Okay, I had a eureka fireball moment, like you're talking about, except it was not because I came up with the idea. It's because I read a paper that showed that somebody else had this exact same problem, totally different context. And then they provided, the mathematical model to solve it, which I actually used the same one. So if you look at the paper, I credit the original authors for their methodology. Now, this was the original authors are Houseman and Wise, are the two last names of the authors, published in 1976.
So Houseman and his wives?
And Wise, W-I-S-E.
What is wrong with you?
Okay, wasn't sure.
Yeah.
I'm trying to clarify. I just want to make sure everybody understood so you can look it up.
It wasn't just a smart, a family of many wives. Houseman and Wise, the two researchers working for the National Bureau of Economic Research in 1976. And what they did is they were looking at a really interesting problem, and they had the same problem as us, which is what kind of caught my eye. This was like super interesting. They were doing research on if they take people in different income categories and supplement their income so that they have sort of a constant higher level of income. Some of it's guaranteed, some of it they work for. They were wondering what the effect that would be on the number of hours that those people would work. Like if you give people money basically guaranteed for free, not related to their work, do they end up working fewer hours?
Yes, I'm tracking.
Right. And so the problem was, is you could not get into the study if your income was above some certain level. They were looking at the poverty level and they had different ratios or multiples of the poverty level, like 1.1, 1.2 times the poverty level. So right at the poverty level, a little bit more, a little bit more. But at some point they would just cut it off and say, anybody making more than this can't be in our study. Like, that's not what we're interested in. The problem with that is now once they were supplementing the incomes, some people's incomes outside of the supplement would grow and some of them would grow less. And they would grow into the zone where, people that were cut out of the study actually—
They got truncated.
Yes.
And exactly, they were truncated. Now, in this case, it was an upper truncation. So if you had an income higher than some multiple of the poverty level—
You couldn't be
in the program. You could not apply for this program and you were not part of the study. And so what the researchers were arguing, if we just do a best fit line to the data we have, we're actually missing all of this upper income population. We deliberately cut it out. Like, it's there. We just did not include it. So how does that affect our study? And in their case, people before them that were doing similar studies were finding there was a very muted effect of this income supplementation, meaning, people were working the same amount of hours or close to. But they were saying if you account for truncation, now it's actually a much more significant effect, meaning people would actually curtail their number of hours if they were getting supplemented income. And they thought that that was a more accurate result. So in any case, completely different field of study, but they had the exact same mathematical problem that we have, which is we have a data set, we're trying to fit sort of a best line to it, but some of the data is missing. So how do we account for that missing part? They had a very clever methodology. Their methodology was based on you know, looking at the scatter and the data. Mm. And then when there was a cutoff line, kind of making an assumption about what was down there based on the characterization of the rest of the plot. And so they were kind of guessing, you know, it is a model, but it turned out in many cases that this is a very accurate way of trying to estimate what's missing. And then you draw the best fit line through the real data and kind of what you estimate to be missing. And that best fit line is more on a 45.
And so that has, you took a practical application from another industry and brought it into ours. And that is really cool. And has obviously implications on a level three. That's what we're driving at. So what are the implications if operators don't do this? It's that the slope of the line gets mixed up. What does that mean?
Right. Well, if the slope of the line is shallower, usually the way it's plotted, you know, it depends on what you choose for your X and Y axes. But usually what it means is that the ILI is undercalling the deeper features. So I don't know if you guys have seen that in your experience. I've seen that in many data sets I look at where you have an ILI tool and it's calling some depth, maximum depth. Then you go out to the field and you find for the deeper ones, sometimes the field is deeper than what the ILI tool calls, which that's what that narrower or that shallower slope is causing. When in actual fact, if you recorrect it, you'll find that it's more accurate. It is a more accurate measurement.
Yeah. So I just drew it out on a piece of paper. So basically what you're saying, because you have a flatter line, let's say your ILI tool was calling a 60% anomaly, because the slope isn't steeper, it's more shallow. Yeah. When you draw that across to the outcome of ILI possibilities, that band is wider.
Exactly.
So the range of features that it could be gets bigger. Whereas if your slope is higher, that range of ILI features gets a little bit tighter.
Yeah, that's exactly
that's
right.
That's clever, and so, Jason.
And so the kind of the thesis behind this is you have a data set. It's very expensive to get this data set. You want to use the data as best you can. You want to squeeze every little bit of knowledge that you can out of that data. And so when we talk about, you know, the different levels, you know, is it worth it doing level three? Well, in this case, if it's truncated and you're trying to get the maximum amount of knowledge out of that data, I think, you know, accounting for truncation is one thing that gets you a little bit further down that line. You get extract a little bit more knowledge. And in some cases, depending on what you're doing, that might be very useful.
So I'm going to ask you a question. So does this mean I can do less digs and still achieve a level three? Come on, Jason. Is this a cost savings opportunity?
Okay. If I do this, how many digs do I have to do, Jason?
Less digs than what? Less digs than what? And the answer is, I mean, compared to a level three with a shallow slope, yes. But compared to a level two or a level one, the answer is no, and sometimes maybe in some cases. But if you're not characterizing your ILI tool well, that will lead to more digs that are quite expensive. Mm. Each one of them is expensive. Mm. It will lead to more. And if you have a better tolerance band, a narrow tolerance band, and it's, you know, more on a 45 degree, if that turns out to be the case, when you do the calculation, you don't always find that, but you can find that when the tool run was successful and it was very accurate. Then how many more digs do you have to do to stay within your risk threshold to meet regulation? That could be less.
It also allows you to not have to target potentially less injurious features, right? I mean, if we go back to thinking like, where do you normally get that field data? It's because I'm going after stuff that we think is an integrity concern. And that may have a certain morphology or a certain common characteristic, right? It's above 50% deep, or it's a 30 plus tolerance. So you kind of might not have that lower threshold. Now you're not having to potentially allocate resources.
Inefficiently use resources
to go after less impactful integrity features if there's a numerical method applied to it, right? And
that's why I love you, Chris, right there. Yeah.
God damn, you know what I was going to say? That makes me so upset. I introduced this podcast talking about books and other applications and reading, and that doesn't resonate with you, Jason?
Hey, I like...
Right there. We're both reading. We're reading economics and mathematical models.
Everything is for fun. Spawn.
You should love me.
I wasn't as expressive about your, you know, initial tie to behavioral economics, but it actually really did impress me, Brett. So I just didn't say it.
It feels like you just said it after the fact, though. It's a cheap compliment.
No, it's absolutely not.
Did you have lunch yet? You're so spicy today.
You know what? I have a couple of those behavioral economic books. They're amazing. You know, they've kind of affected some of my thinking on similar topics. So I was genuinely impressed. For some reason, I laid back. I didn't say anything, but it's true. It's true, Rhett. You have to.
Jason, I'm totally messing with you. Look, Jason's been fun. I really want to say thanks for joining us. But before, as we wrap up and before we let you go, are you going to be at IPC this year?
Absolutely. I'm going to be there. I'm helping out with one of the tracks. I'll be running one of the tracks.
Awesome.
And I've got a couple papers I'll be presenting as well. So yeah, hope to see you guys out there and any of the listeners as well. Hope to see them out there.
Yeah, we will definitely be there. I'd encourage our listeners, if you get a chance, check out Jason's tracks, check out his papers, and check out this 2022 IPC paper, particularly if you're going to get into level threes. Chris, do you have any words of admiration or love you'd like to pass on Jason before we close out?
Jason, we'll have to have you back on, buddy.
Awesome. I'm all up for it, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jason. So I want to say thanks to our audience for this episode, and we look forward to seeing you back in 2 weeks. Thanks to our guest, and thanks to Jason. Appreciate it. We'll see you back. This episode of Pipeline Things was executive produced by Sarah Roberts. Thank you very much to our guest on the show, Jason Scow of Integral Engineering, our sponsors, D2 Integrity, and we'd like to thank the Work Lodge and Vintage for giving us the space to record the episode.